My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about treatment-resistant depression and whether or not deep brain stimulation could be the answer. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to all of your comments at the end of the show. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield of the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Galway and Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist and science communicator at UCD. You're both very welcome. Jessamine, our first story has to do with Hitler. And I think that's the first time I've ever said that on this programme.
That's probably for the best.
Yeah, maybe.
This is a new, it's not even really a study yet. It's an unpublished study, but which has been publicized in a new documentary, Sequencing the DNA of Hitler.
What?
Yeah. So you might wonder how they were even able to do this.
I mean, well, there's a museum in London, and I think they have one of his balls.
That's...
Now, I'm not sure if I remember that correctly. There's a little quirky museum in London. It's really cool. It's got loads of weird crap in there. And I think it has one of Hitler's balls in there.
Well,
but that's not where they got it.
Keep that in the back of your mind because that ball is going to come back later
on. Oh, really?
So the way that they got this sample is that basically they had some material from the couch that he died on, which was soaked in his blood.
Oh, God.
This is fabric from that couch, which was owned by the Gettysburg Museum of History in the U.S. And it was confirmed that they had the correct DNA sample by comparison to a blood relative of Hitler's. And so they did a DNA sequencing test on it. Now, the results are kind of interesting. Like, they were looking for confirmation or rejection of some theories about Hitler, such as that he was secretly Jewish, which he was not, based on this DNA evidence. But they did find a mutation on this specific gene, PROK2, which is related to something called Kallmann syndrome. So Kallmann syndrome is a defect of this gene, which can, in some cases, delay puberty. It can cause the testicles to not descend. And actually, it was known from a prison record, actually, of Hitler's from the 1923 beer hall putsch that he had one testicle which was undescended. So probably the one that you are familiar with was the other testicle, I guess.
Ah.
I didn't know. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just Googled it. Yeah, no, that was some guy who was pulling a trick on me.
No.
It's one of those, you know, museum of curiosities, and it seems very unlikely because he only had one testicle, one descendant. It's very unlikely that
also,
they have that
set
specific
him on fire.
One.
Why and how would they have been able to recover one testicle?
I'm sorry. Have you seen, you know, Platoon or any of those war movies? They do some pretty bad things.
Maybe it's okay that none of us are familiar with Hitler's testicles. I think that, you know, to me, one of the things that really jumped out about this story, it had like such attention-grabbing headlines, and it is, again, just from a documentary, like it's submitted for peer review but not reviewed yet. Mm. I feel like we as people have this temptation to look at, you know, people who did horrible stuff and be like, well, but what makes them different from me? Like, they got to be different from me somehow, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would never do that. So,
yeah.
Like, there's a genetic thing, right? Or like, something has to be different. And I mean, you know, yeah, there was a genetic finding here, but lots of people have Kallmann syndrome and don't commit genocide.
Yeah.
Like, lots of people have these various issues and never do anything bad. And there's lots of people who do bad stuff and are surprisingly like us. I mean, we can look at Hitler and say, well, why did he commit these genocides? Is it something like written in the instructions of his DNA? And it's like there's people committing genocides now who probably are a lot more similar to us than we'd like to think.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I very much subscribe to this idea that trying to find the otherness of bad people is crazy, that we all have a spectrum. We all have levers of our personality and triggers, environment, DNA, all that stuff. We're all very, very similar. I certainly believe that I am a product, because I have a chat with Kevin Mitchell, a neuroscientist,
yeah.
And he talks a lot about, you know, we have free will. And I feel like whatever free will I have is like a horse with blinders. Maybe very few options because I make decisions based on...
You're more of a mule than a horse.
I was in the middle of a very deep philosophical argument there. Shut up, Shane. God damn it. All right, fine. What is your story?
It's about...
I bet it's rubbish.
Food, Jonathan.
Right. Boring. Absolutely.
No, this is really... Actually, this is three papers
in
the Lancet.
Is it Hitler's testicle and DNA?
But this is like, you know, slow peer-reviewed science. And it's pretty shocking what they've done in the Lancet, which for listeners is one of the highest impact journals out there. Three papers back to back in one issue, and they're about ultra processed food, right? So there is a scale out there to determine the degree of processedness for food, going from one, which is completely fresh food, up to four, which is the stuff that we all think of, right? You know,
kind but actually, the bit in between one and four, there's lots of stuff that even you would go, oh, really?
Yeah, like breakfast cereal. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And things you and I would eat every day. Yeah. You mightn't think it. What they've done here is that they have looked at 104 long-term studies, and they've been able to kind of, it's an analysis of pre-existing work over a long time. And what they've been able to show is that ultra-processed food is linked to harm in every major organ of the human body, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And not only that, is that they're what they do very, very skillfully here is they get into it, right? As to why are we doing this to ourselves? What's driving it? What are the harms? Etc. So they highlight that there are various non-communicable diseases, things that you can't catch from somebody else, like obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, etc. And they're all being linked to the amount and of ultra-processed food we're eating. And they're saying in it that this is very cleverly done. I see similarities between the tobacco industry and indeed big oil right here, and talking about powerful global corporations who employ sophisticated political tactics to protect what they're doing.
Yeah. Right?
They also say, which was a bit of a shock to me, based on their analysis, that education and relying on behavioural change is completely insufficient, right? Asking the individual to kind of, you know, to fix themselves is not going to work.
Yeah. What are you going to do in that environment? Yeah. If you live in a wasteland where, you know, the supermarket produce is not the highest grade because it's different grades and the leafy suburbs get the better grades. I mean, it is really, really tricky.
So what they say here is that basically that we must become conscious of the fact that we're, you know, we're completely advertised and manipulated too, and that there are a lot of lobbying going on to make sure that that's your only option. And they say that whilst education and behavioural change is important, really what it needs to, is coordinated policies and regulation, advocacy, etc. The things that I don't think even our country are able to do with something like the size of the EU possibly is able to do. And I just think about procurement and things like that, is that what happens if healthiness becomes a driver as opposed to just you know, money. And they do, you know, this review is very, very good because they're not kind of trying to be high and mighty about it. And they're saying equity, of course, has to be really important. You need to make fresh food cheap.
Yeah. And also it needs to be highly nutritious, as we've learned, highly processed or highly farmed food isn't as nutritious as it was. So it's all bad news. Jess, our third story has to do with...
animals.
Yes.
No.
Although you said animals in a really sweet way that made people think, oh, at least some good news.
It's nice to think about animals. But unfortunately, this story is about how animals get sick like us. And specifically that they get chronic diseases. There actually is some tie to the story that Shane just had, because this is also research that's basically looking at prevalence of things like diabetes, degenerative joint diseases, obesity. So these non-communicable chronic diseases, and that they are increasing in different types of animals like pets, livestock, and even marine animals. For a long time, you know, these kind of diseases seemed like kind of rich Western country type diseases. And it was like, oh, you know, imagine like a horse running around in a field. Sure, they wouldn't get diabetes, would they? And no, they would, unfortunately, because they're subject to a lot of the same issues in terms of not enough physical activity, poor or ultra processed diet, and stress that we are in the modern world. Mm. And, you know, there's some types of animals as well that are feeling the stress from climate change, degeneration of their ecosystems. But I also found it interesting. This is research out of the Agricultural University of Athens. They showed in livestock a link between livestock being bred for productivity and increased instances of these chronic diseases. And even things like cats and dogs, you know, our pets, when they're bred for looks rather than kind of their function, they also have increased instances of these chronic diseases. So, yeah, I mean, It is not a happy story about animals, especially because at least I had kind of thought, oh, well, at least they don't get chronic diseases like we do. And it's like, no, they're part of our world. They're getting the same things.
Yeah, they get cancer and yeah, you know, all those sort of things.
But you know what I think we could learn from is the naked mole rat. So
yes,
the naked mole rat, which if you don't know what one looks like, you should definitely look it up. They are very ugly. But they don't get cancer or diabetes. They have these kind of genetic quirks that people are still studying to try to understand why they're immune to so many of these sort of modern maladies. They actually also don't really age. It's really hard to tell the age of a naked mole rat. They rarely die of natural causes. So I think, you know, instead of breeding things for looks like we've done with cats and dogs or productivity.
You want us all to have naked mole rats as pets.
I want us all to be naked mole rats. I want us to be like ugly but happy. And just kind of embrace that as a lifestyle. And eventually when you go out fighting. That's my dream for us.
I say no to that. Shane, our final story.
Yes, first kiss dates back 21 million years ago.
I saw this headline and I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
And it's not when you started going out as a young man 21 million years ago, Jonathan. Instead, this is, I was thinking of that in advance. So humans are not the only animals that kiss. It's monkeys, polar bears, big cats, etc.
Polar bears?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never seen a polar bear kiss.
And scientists, I know.
You wouldn't.
yeah, exactly. Scientists are interested, as it seems there's no obvious survival or reproductive benefit for kissing, but it's widespread, right? Of course, this is like typical science. It's like just something that's nice and we have to ruin it. So what they were doing is they were looking at animals that kiss and they were trying to figure out, was there an evolutionary family tree? In other words, could they go back to the first species that might have had done this? And it's published in the Journal of Evolution.
Oh, wait,
Human
so
Behavior.
They look like 10 different species and they're trying to find a common ancestor for those species.
Exactly.
And figure that's what I think.
Yeah, now
does
they
that
do
work
it,
from a scientific point of view?
You can use something called Bayesian phylogenetic methods, which is a combination of data and then...
That's how I would have done it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and probabilities. So you're able to look at a multitude of different family trees and figure out which one is most probable. But to do this, I think this is the best bit in here, is that they had to actually make a scientific definition of what a kiss is, right? So, quote, a non-aggressive, direct oral-oral contact with some movement of lips or other mouth parts, and crucially, no food transfer.
Jesus Christ. That's how I ask whether or not I can kiss somebody.
Yes.
So would you like?
Yeah, would you like?
An oral to oral.
Yeah,
non-aggressive, non-food transfer,
right?
Non-aggressive.
Yeah, no food transfer and some movement of lips. So
what is the animal that first kissed?
Well, it's some genetic kind of ancient animal that we don't know about, really.
What? We don't have a name for it?
No, it does not that I figured here and there, but it's 21 million years ago was the common ancestor, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to have a photograph of it or something.
Oh, no. Next week.
Thank you to Dr. Shane Bergen and to Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. We all know severe depression is completely debilitating. It's difficult for those who live with it and those who care about those who live with it. What if a tiny implant in your brain could help? Well, new research shows that deep brain stimulation can help some treatment-resistant patients. Professor Valerie Voon is a professor of neuropsychiatry and neuromodulation at the University of Cambridge. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Valerie. Tell me a little bit about deep brain stimulation, what we know about it as a neurosurgical procedure.
So deep brain stimulation, also known as DBS, is a little bit like a brain pacemaker. So it involves a neurosurgical procedure where very slender electrodes are placed into specific brain regions, so two are put in, and then there's a pacemaker underneath a chest fat pad, which acts like a heart pacemaker, but it's actually pacing the abnormal brain rhythms. So it normalizes abnormal brain signals and it changes how different brain regions talk to each other. It's very effective for Parkinson's disease and used routinely for severe refractory Parkinson's disease, amongst other movement disorders.
Oh, this sounds a lot more sophisticated than I first thought this device was. Does a deep brain stimulation implant, would that do much more than create an electrical current? Or is there intelligence built into an implant like that?
So usually it's delivered as what we call high frequency stimulation, which is just continuous stimulation at a pretty high frequency, 140, 130 hertz.
And that stimulation is electrical?
It's electrical stimulation, yes. Okay. Yeah, and what it's doing is it's probably suppressing and inhibiting abnormal physiological or brain signals. So say if we take Parkinson's, for instance, we know that the tremor is associated with these abnormal, what we call beta bursting, and it suppresses that abnormal signals. And it also can kind of change how different brain regions interact and talk to each other.
Right. Okay. So so we know exactly why it works? I mean, it's kind of funny, like there's a lot of things in medicine really that we know it works, but we're not entirely sure why it works. Do we know why deep brain stimulation works for something like Parkinson's, for example?
So we know that it acts not very similar to what we call a lesion. So if you you decrease activity of a specific brain region by lesioning it, it can have the same effect as deep brain stimulation. So it's probably what known as inhibiting activity.
Right.
But depending on the brain region, it can also increase activity. So it sort of depends on which brain region you're talking about.
Okay. And so you would target different parts of the brain for different types of conditions, presumably. But my understanding is that there aren't distinct regions for any real task. There's quite a mix, right? But there are some regions that are more associated with certain types of tasks.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that we target different brain regions depending on the disorder. Mm. So in Parkinson's, it's a very specific area called the subthalamic nucleus. But actually, we target different areas of the subthalamic nucleus for either Parkinson's disease, which is more motor, and we target the same subthalamic nucleus, but much more, a slightly different area that's more emotional and more related to thinking processes. And for things
and that's for like, depression.
For depression, it's a slightly different brain region. So there's a couple different brain regions that people have been targeting, and they're all associated with emotional processing and how we might, think about how we interact with the world and our emotions.
Right. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about severe depression first. So when we're talking about severe depression and treatment-resistant depression, what exactly are we talking about there?
It's a very specific definition. So this isn't appropriate for all forms of depression. It's really just for those people who have failed multiple trials of antidepressants, usually failed ECT, failed psychotherapy, and there's not a lot of other options available for them. So the indication is only for severe treatment refractory depression.
Right. And the person who has severe depression, what sort of symptoms would they have? How can they function day to day? And what sort of treatments are typically given to these patients before this innovation?
So someone with depression will present with either very blunted mood or very depressed mood. They're not sleeping well. They're not eating well. They're usually mostly sitting at home and unable to work, unable to function, interact with their family, or go to school. These people would have been through multiple trials of different forms of antidepressants, of different classes, also either add-on medications, in addition to things like psychotherapy and also ECT.
Electroconvulsive therapy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So, and that for some, obviously for many people, that is seen as a last resort. Is there a reason why ECT why deep brain stimulation is, because obviously you have to access the brain, it's a higher, it's more invasive in some respects, but of course in other respects it really isn't. Why and what are the benefits of deep brain stimulation over something like ECT?
So I will say that ECT is effective, particularly for severe depression and people who need a very fast relief.
But there are side effects to it.
There can be side effects to ECT, yes, absolutely, in terms of cognitive side effects. And you're sort of balancing kind of risks and benefits, if you will.
Yeah.
So DBS, deep brain stimulation, does act differently in that it's much more targeted, right? So whereas ECT is causing a fairly generalized seizure across the brain, what this is doing is actually we're targeting very specific brain regions, which we think are related to the underlying pathology of depression, and then able to reach other networks. So it's like a hub, if you will, like you can think of a train hub that reaches multiple networks.
Right.
And we're targeting that.
With a deep brain stimulation device, then you have multiple sites kind of buzzing the brain at different at the same time, but in different areas. It's not one single implant. And if so, how do you access those parts of the brain? Is it through the scalp or is it on the scalp?
So it's two implants, one on each side of the brain, but it is a single target. But because there are four different what we call contacts, so areas that you can stimulate, you can actually reach a couple different brain regions because through that same electrode. So in our case, we were targeting an area, it's called the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis. It's really just an area involved in fear processing. Mm. And then in another target, we were targeting an area called the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in things like motivation and reward.
Mm.
And so it's the same two electrodes on either side of the brain.
So let's quickly talk about the results. What happened? What did you find when you used deep brain stimulation to try and help patients with severe depression?
So we looked at 26 patients, and again, we were targeting this area called the BNST. We showed that 50% or half of these patients were what we call clinical responders. Okay, so meaning that their depression scores improved by more than 50%. And that is clinically meaningful for the patient.
Yeah, I bet it is. 50% is pretty big. And like a sort of intervention like that is only to be dreamed of, right? I mean, if it stays, like a 50% increase is very difficult to get in it with other treatments.
Yes, exactly. And these people have failed multiple other treatments. Mm. The other, we also had an improvement in other meaningful quality of life measures. So that was what we found from a clinical perspective. The kind of other two main findings were that we found what we would call objective biomarkers. So it's kind of like objective lab tests, if you will. So one was a deep brain signal, and it's called theta activity. It's just a form of a brain signal deep inside this brain region. And then it also connects and has crosstalk with the front of the brain. And that signal predicts whether someone improves on deep brain stimulation or not at 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months.
Oh, wow. So you can actually know whether or not this is going to work for the patient as well.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that it allows us then to say, if you see this biomarker, and we also had another behavioral correlate of it. And if you see these things, it can tell you, would this person improve with this form of DBS at this particular target?
Exactly. I guess the real question is, how long do these effects last? How long did you follow these patients with severe depression, and how long were their symptoms alleviated to that level of 50%?
So this has been a long-standing study, and we ran the open-label arm, which was 6 months, but actually some of these patients were followed up for a year and a half before we started the randomized control trial. So that part wasn't reported in this paper. We have it in another paper,
right,
which is, again, positive. And that one, again, we've had this crossover trial where we switched off the stimulator just to be sure, in a blinded manner, to be sure that what we were seeing in the open label arm, it was actually effective.
Hmm.
And these people, I think still have the stimulator in place, and, it's been more than 2-3 years now.
Wow. And they're still reporting that level of improved mental health?
We're still following them up to ensure that's the case. And
yeah.
In other long-term studies in, with DBS for depression targeting other regions, they also show this kind of clear longitudinal effect.
The implant itself stays in like a Parkinson's deep brain stimulator. It stays and it can be activated by the patient, or is it done on intervals, or is it only done when they visit the clinic?
So we just keep it on. So usually we keep it on.
It's always okay.
All the time. It might be decreased at night, but there are ways of starting to think about, can we switch it off perhaps when the person doesn't have any symptoms and then get it to trigger on automatically when they do have symptoms? And that's where the field is moving.
Really exciting. Professor Valerie Voon from the University of Cambridge, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, it's time to look back at some of the comments from last week's episode, and we were talking about the proposal to have astronauts try to grow bacteria that is fed by protein that comes from the astronaut's own urine. Catherine says, is that a form of micro-cannibalism? I don't know if it counts, Catherine, because technically they're eating the bacteria, not the protein. So I'm not sure. We were also talking about mirror life and this idea that it is possible to create life using a bit of funny chemistry that is right-handed when all living life is left-handed. It was a really interesting piece. But someone says, I wonder if mirror life could compete for resources, food or space with natural life, given that many nutrients are chiral themselves. Or maybe it would be limited by what mirror nutrients it can use. Well, I guess if the nutrients that it's eating are nutrients like organic, then it would need to be able to see them. I don't know. I actually don't know. But I know minerals don't have a handedness. So presumably minerals it would be able to get. But actually any biological life, I'm not sure. Really good question, Louise. We might ask our contributor. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, who was producing elegantly this week. Rory Galvin, Hugo De Silva, Scott were on research and sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.